They were very, very sweet little girls. And the last time I saw little Aubrey, she, you know, was missing her two front teeth.
On the 25th of December 2017, Beach Drive and Goodwin Street in Oak Bay, Victoria, Canada, buzzed with the spirit of Christmas. The homes and apartments were aglow with festive cheer, from decorated Christmas trees, windows shimmering with twinkling lights, and even the presence of illuminated Santas and candy canes. Later on, however, the atmosphere in the neighbourhood took an unexpected turn, as the festive lighting was replaced by jarring flashing lights from police vehicles swarming the area. Oak Bay is a seaside community of around 20,000 in the Greater Victoria area of Canada. Sarah Cotton called Oak Bay home, and in 2009 she crossed paths with a man named Andrew Berry. They were both working at BC Ferries, a publicly owned ferry service that provided transport between the mainland and various coastal islands. Before that, Sarah had gained experience as an intern at the University of Victoria and later worked in communications at Tartan Group. Their initial connection blossomed into a family with the birth of two daughters, Chloe in 2011 and Aubrey in 2013. However, despite a promising start, Sarah and Andrew's relationship eventually took a dark turn. The turbulence began to surface shortly after the tragic death of Sarah's father in 2013. Andrew's behaviour became increasingly problematic, marked by frequent outbursts and verbal abuse directed at Sarah. These instances of aggression escalated, leaving Sarah feeling vulnerable and bereft of the protection she once relied upon. During one heated argument over the family's universal childcare benefit, Andrew threatened to blow up the house. The strain on their relationship manifested in Andrew's erratic and dangerous behaviour, especially when he became angry. He would drive recklessly and speed, even when their young daughters were passengers in the car. The once promising marriage had devolved into a tumultuous and unsafe environment for Sarah and her children. After a couple of months, Sarah reached a breaking point, and she decided to end the relationship with Andrew. Things came to a head on the day that he was scheduled to move out of the family home. Sarah was alone in the bedroom when Andrew burst in and pinned her to the bed, holding her down by her wrists. Once Sarah broke free, she grabbed her cell phone and called police, who arrived promptly and arrested Andrew. Sarah obtained a restraining order that kept him from contacting her or the girls. After Andrew moved into his own apartment, Sarah and the girls continued with life. Sarah assumed the role of a single mother, showering her two girls with affection and dedicating all of her time to them. This routine persisted for 3 months before a peace bond was amended, allowing Andrew supervised visits with Chloe and Aubrey. However, the subsequent years brought forth challenges surrounding child support and the co-ownership of their home. Despite a court order mandating child support payments, Andrew refused to comply for 2 years. Eventually, Sarah was granted the opportunity to acquire Andrew's $60,000 share of their home for approximately $20,000, with the judge taking into account the outstanding child support that he owed. The situation took an even darker turn when Sarah discovered a soft spot on Aubrey's head after her return from her father's care. Another time, Aubrey reported that her father had inappropriately touched her genitals. These alarming revelations triggered an investigation by the Ministry of Children and Family Development into Andrew's conduct. Throughout the inquiry, Andrew's visits with Chloe and Aubrey were supervised, and ministry officials recommended that he undergo parenting classes. However, they found no evidence that the touching was sexual or criminal in nature. The custody battle reached its climax when it went to trial towards the end of 2016. Sarah expressed concerns about Andrew's ability to properly care for the girls, accusing him of once leaving one of them in a stroller in a public place, a short distance from his vision. She also alleged that he spoke negatively about her to their daughters, and cited Aubrey's claims of inappropriate touching. In response, Andrew vehemently denied the accusations, testifying that he had tickled Aubrey rather than engaged in inappropriate touching. The courtroom became a battleground for conflicting narratives, each side presenting their version of events in a bid to determine the future of the family dynamic. Justice Victoria Gray delivered the final ruling, awarding majority custody to Sarah, while Andrew was granted intermittent custody on a 14-day rotating schedule. This schedule included overnight stays on weekdays and weekends, as well as almost every other holiday. In making the announcement, Justice Gray acknowledged, "The father is a loving father who has much to offer his daughters." However, she voiced concerns about Andrew's care for the girls, citing the accusations made by Sarah. Justice Gray further remarked, "Andrew has displayed poor judgment in dealing with the children. This has included saying negative things to the girls about the mother, touching which led to the MCFD investigation, and his present arrangement of sometimes sleeping together with one or more of the girls." Despite these concerns, the judge ultimately concluded that Andrew's aggressive behaviour was transient and relatively minor. Justice Gray's decision was grounded in the assessment that Chloe and Aubrey were generally happy and healthy. She believed that their well-being would be enhanced by maintaining a relationship with their father through scheduled visits. The judge sought to strike a balance between recognizing Andrew's positive qualities as a parent and addressing the valid concerns raised about his judgment and behaviour in caring for the girls. By now, Chloe was 6 years old while Aubrey was 4. Both were vibrant and content little girls, each with their unique personalities and interests. Chloe was a grade 1 student at Christchurch Cathedral School, and she had recently developed a passion for horseback riding, which was being taught by her cousin. Her family described her as remarkably wise, clever and articulate, possessing an open heart and a keen sense of humour. Chloe was known for her considerate nature and artistic flair. As for Aubrey, she was in the process of transitioning from toddlerhood to a little girl, displaying burgeoning self-assurance and determination. Described by her family as a spirited and wild child, Aubrey found joy in silliness and reveling in her mother's makeup. In her final year of preschool at St. Christopher's Montessori School, Aubrey had recently taken on the role of Gabriel the Angel in the Nativity pageant, showcasing her evolving confidence. Tricia Lees, a friend of Sarah, fondly said of the girls, "They were just full of energy, full of smiles, full of giggles, and very silly. Like most little girls their age, they like to have lots of fun." Both Aubrey and Chloe shared a passion for art and enjoyed expressing themselves through drawing. Their sisterly bond was a source of joy for them, providing constant companionship and playtime. Family friend Valerie Jerome recollected to CBC,
"They were very, very sweet little girls, and the last time I saw little Aubrey, she, you know, was missing her two front teeth, and she was looking forward to going to kindergarten. I guess I saw them on the Labor Day weekend before they started at their new schools, and they were keen about starting their new schools. It was just lovely to see their joy."
In the aftermath of the separation, Sarah's devotion to her daughters became even more pronounced. Tricia reflected on Sarah's maternal qualities, stating, "Sarah was just one of those mothers who was born to be a mother and did an exceptionally great job with them in every possible way." Despite the challenges, the resilient bond between Sarah and her daughters always shone through. According to the custody agreement, Chloe and Aubrey were to spend Christmas of 2017 with their father. On the evening of December 21st, Sarah dropped off the girls at their father's apartment on Beach Drive and Goodwin Street. His apartment was in a very desirable area, just a stone's throw from the marina and overlooking the Pacific coast. The neighbourhood was adorned with festive decorations, with twinkling lights on roofs, Christmas trees visible through windows, and colourful candy canes displayed outside. Despite the festive atmosphere, Andrew's apartment was unusually dark. Pulling up outside, Sarah wondered if Andrew was home. Chloe reassured her, explaining that the lights were always off at their father's place. Turning to her mother, she cheerfully said, "We use flashlights. It's just like camping." Aware of Andrew's financial struggle since leaving his job in May, Sarah wondered whether the electricity had been disconnected, but decided not to bring it up. Chloe's comment lingered in her mind, and she considered discussing it later, not wanting to spoil Christmas. She made a mental note to address it at a more appropriate time. Sarah bid farewell to her daughters, reminding them to be on their best behavior, before returning home alone to finalize the touches for Christmas Day. Step into the new year with a resolution to declutter and organize, and let Smart Labels be your guiding light. Say goodbye to the chaos of misplaced items and tangled messes. Welcome a world of order and efficiency with their cutting-edge app and QR labels. Simply purchase their color-coded Smart Labels from their website, qrsmartlabels.com, Amazon or Walmart. Then download the Smart Labels app from the Apple App Store or Google Play to effortlessly create a digital inventory of each box. No more lost moments searching for that one item you know you packed away somewhere, and ensure that your New Year's resolution to be more organized becomes a reality. Embrace the future of streamlined living, where technology meets tidiness. Make sure to click the link in my show notes to simplify your storage organization today. The plan was for Chloe and Aubrey to spend time with their father, Andrew, until noon on Christmas Day, after which he would return them to Sarah. The next morning, however, Sarah found herself making an unplanned visit back to Andrew's apartment. Chloe had left behind her favourite stuffed toy, Lammy, and Sarah drove over to return it. Parking outside the apartment, she gently tapped on the window. Chloe and Aubrey's faces appeared through the blinds, welcoming their mother with smiles. Sarah recollected. Chloe had a dragon costume on. It had a tail. I told them that I loved them, and I hugged them. As Christmas dawned, Sarah awoke in her empty home, eagerly counting down the moments until her girls returned. Their Christmas presents were wrapped and waiting for them underneath the Christmas tree, while their stockings were filled to the brim with gifts. Anticipating Chloe and Aubrey's arrival at noon, and her parents, Brenda and Malcolm, joining at 2 p.m, Sarah's excitement was palpable. However, as noon came and went, Andrew failed to appear with the girls. Sarah frantically called and texted Andrew, but her calls and texts went unanswered. She then called his sister, but her calls to Andrew also went unanswered. Sarah's parents, Brenda and Malcolm, arrived at 2 p.m, and it was decided that Sarah and Brenda would travel over to Andrew's apartment. Sarah speculated that Andrew was being difficult just for the sake of being difficult. Malcolm stayed behind in case Andrew and the girls returned. Upon arriving at the apartment, Sarah and Brenda knocked on one of the front windows, expecting to see the girls' faces pop up behind the blinds. However, the apartment appeared to be eerily silent. Fanning out to parks and recreation centres and leaving unanswered voicemails, Sarah and Brenda's desperation grew. Returning to the apartment, they sought information from a neighbour who had heard the girls earlier but had noticed silence since. According to another neighbour, loud crashing noises and thuds could be heard coming from the apartment that morning. Panic set in, and without hesitation, Sarah and Brenda reported the girls missing. Constable Peter Olenowski from Oak Bay was the first to arrive outside Andrew's apartment after Sarah reported Chloe and Aubrey missing. He too knocked on the front door, but there was no response. Turning the handle, he discovered the door was unlocked. Slowly opening it, he found the interior shrouded in darkness. With the flick of a switch on his flashlight, Constable Olenowski illuminated a horrifying scene. Blood smeared across the walls and floor. When he called out to Andrew and the girls, he was met by silence. As his flashlight swept across the rooms, he spotted what appeared to be a small lifeless form on one of the beds. Disturbed by the sight, he closed the door behind him and called for backup. Moments later, Sergeant Michael Martin, the constable's supervisor, arrived at the apartment. In shock, Olenowski said he believed he saw a lifeless body in one of the bedrooms. The two entered the apartment together, with Martin noting the pervasive darkness, illuminated only by the haunting traces of blood that stood out with the bright light from the flashlights. Upgrading the incident from a Code 3 to a Code 4, denouncing the severity, Martin drew his firearm, uncertain of what they were going to find inside. Passing the decorated Christmas tree, they followed one of the trails of blood into the bathroom. Shining their flashlights into the pitch-black room, they illuminated a bloody bathtub. Lying naked in the bathtub was Andrew, bearing stab wounds to his chest and throat. His chest was slowly moving up and down with each laboured breath that he was taking. Martin instructed Olenowski to stay with Andrew while he continued his search. He entered the master bedroom, where he found a bed that was saturated with blood. On top there was a small figure with blood-matted hair and blood-stained pyjamas. It was Chloe. Desperately checking for a pulse, Martin found none, and Chloe's cold, stiff body bore evidence of lacerations and stab wounds. A bloody baseball bat was entangled in her blood-soaked hair. Radioing dispatch, Martin reported a deceased child and an injured man, urgently requesting an ambulance. Continuing his search, he followed the blood trail to the second bedroom. Illuminating the scene, he could see the blood was splattered on the walls, floor, and even on the horizontal blinds. On the bed lay Aubrey. She was clad in blood-soaked pajamas, and she wasn't moving. Like her older sister, she displayed signs of laceration and stab wounds, her body also cold and stiff. Martin contacted dispatch and said he would do a second check of pulses. But before he did, Oak Bay Constable Sandrine Perry arrived on the scene. She offered to check the pulses, and as Martin later recollected, "We decided it was prudent to get a second opinion. I was hoping I was wrong." However, Martin wasn't wrong. Both Chloe and Aubrey were dead, and far beyond resuscitation measures. Rigor mortis had already set in, indicating they had been dead for some time. Andrew, however, was still alive. In the bathroom, first responders worked on him with minimal lighting. They noted chest wounds, a throat wound, and a large swollen eye. However, none of the injuries appeared to be actively or profusely bleeding. There wasn't enough room in the bathroom to tend to Andrew, so paramedics planned on bringing him out into the hallway. As they carefully lifted him from the bathtub onto a stretcher, he uttered, "Kill me, just kill me." The apartment was shrouded in crime scene tape as Andrew was transported to the hospital, accompanied by Olenowski. Martin harbored fears that Andrew might not survive the journey, and later remarked, "Sometimes when people pass away, they sometimes do dying declarations." In the early stages of the investigation, detectives already had a theory. They suspected that Andrew had taken the lives of Chloe and Aubrey before attempting to end his own. Simultaneously, Chloe and Aubrey were taken to the medical examiner's office, where an autopsy laid bare the extent of their injuries. Chloe had suffered a brutal blow to the head with a baseball bat, fracturing her skull. She was then subjected to 26 stab wounds, some inflicted prior to her death, and others post-mortem. Aubrey had endured 32 stab wounds, leading to fatal bleeding. The brutality of the crimes became starkly evident as both girls have been turned over at least twice by their killer to inflict stab wounds on both sides. At the crime scene, detectives persisted in their examination. Inside the bathroom, a pair of jeans stiffened with dried blood and a long-sleeved t-shirt saturated in blood were discovered. In Aubrey's bedroom, a black-handled knife lay abandoned on the floor. Forensic experts meticulously combed through the apartment, grappling with the overwhelming volume of blood. A specialized team was summoned to navigate the extensive blood evidence, uncovering transfer stains, swipe and wipe marks, as well as finger marks throughout the apartment. The living room displayed a drip trail of blood, along with 21 patterned socked foot transfer stains. In the kitchen, swipe and wipe marks adorned the fridge, stove, and select portions of the cabinet. Blood was also found inside a kitchen drawer, indicating that somebody with contaminated hands had rummaged through it. The evidence painted a vivid picture of someone bleeding, moving methodically from room to room, even pausing to sit on beds in each bedroom before resuming their morbid journey. Void spaces of blood at the end of each bed revealed where the fatal blows were inflicted upon Chloe and Aubrey. Amidst the chaos, a note in the living room caught the detective's attention, a glimmer of normalcy. The message innocently conveyed holiday cheer, reading, "Dear Santa, enjoy the bunny crackers from Chloe, Aubrey and Andy. Merry Christmas." Another note from the girls offered Santa an unopened toothbrush for after he ate the crackers. In a different room, the discovery of a suicide note in Andrew's handwriting, addressed to his sister, revealed a lengthy list of frustrations with their mother and Sarah. It expressed sentiments of feeling betrayed, bullied and miscast, reading, "I set out to leave with the kids. I love you and your children, but I felt it better for myself and kids to escape." Forensic experts continued their investigation, revealing no signs of forced entry in the apartment. Despite the bloody crime scene within, including footprints, hand marks, and finger marks, there was an absence of blood outside. The lack of blood on the door handle and the absence of bloody footprints leading to the front door contradicted the notion that the killer had left the apartment. The evidence within the apartment strengthened the theory that Andrew had committed the unthinkable. Detectives theorized that after attacking his daughter, he retreated to the bathroom, shed his blood-stained clothing, entered the bath, and then attempted to take his own life. Simultaneously, Andrew underwent surgery at the hospital, but his injuries weren't life-threatening. Upon awakening, he was guarded by detectives. He never once inquired about his daughter's well-being or questioned the events. During a visit from his sister, he pointed to his chest injury and uttered, "I did this." Following his discharge from the hospital, Andrew faced 2 counts of second-degree murder. Sarah was already at the police station with her parents when she was informed that her girls had been killed. The silence of the police station was shattered by her deafening screams. She later recollected of the moment. "I screamed like never before. I was in such shock." The family were seeking privacy and designated Sarah's close friend Tricia as their spokesperson. In a public statement, she announced, "Sarah has a couple of us that have been with her ever since, taking care of her as best we can. We're very grateful for the remarkable outpouring of support from everywhere." While the family grappled with their grief in seclusion, Christchurch Cathedral School warmly welcomed parents, children, and those connected to Aubrey's preschool. A poignant candlelight vigil was organised to honour the memory of the girls. Stuart Hall, the school's head, expressed to reporters, "It's a terrible, deep, and jagged tragedy that we're all facing." Despite the holiday closure, the school took proactive measures by arranging counselling services to aid children and their families in navigating the challenging grieving process. Oak Bay United Church also extended a supportive hand, with Reverend Michelle Slater announcing extended hours for the church the following day. The church became a haven for people to gather, light candles, pray, or seek solace in quiet reflection. Reverend Slater explained, I thought the first thing we could do is just open the church building, have the sanctuary open, have some music playing. This episode is sponsored by Unfold Integral Coaching. Hey, how many things are you doing right now, listening to this podcast? That's one. Are you also driving, cooking, working out, scrolling through social media? And what's on your mind? All those unanswered texts, that looming deadline, that worry about that issue that won't go away. You've got a lot going on. In this crazy world, we all do. And we're losing touch with our natural ability for deep healing rest. That means most of us are living with a dysregulated nervous system that keeps us on edge during the day, wide awake at night, and snapping at the people we love the most. But here's the thing, you have the power to shift your body from fight or flight to rest and digest. And Christina Bonnet Acosta, a Stanford-educated integral coach, wants to teach you how for free. She's offering a no-cost 30-minute coaching session to 50 of 90,000 listeners for the holidays. You'll log out of Zoom feeling deeply relaxed and equipped with two proven techniques for finding calm in any chaos. Buddhist teacher Lama Pema Drakpa describes Christina as one of the most caring and insightful people he has ever encountered. And a past client said, "For me, every session with Christina has meant real, long-lasting transformation." So if you're tired of being held hostage by your own nervous system, grab your free session at www.christinabonnet.com. The link will be in the show notes before it goes back to its normal price of 65 euros. You're just 30 minutes away from finding flow in your body, mind, and life. In response to the tragic double murder, the District of Oak Bay orchestrated a candlelight vigil at Willows Beach on December 30th. The speech held a special place in Chloe and Aubrey's hearts. Being their favourite spot in the city, boasting miles of pristine white sand where they enjoyed building sandcastles and playing in the water with their mother on weekends. Around 2,000 residents came together to pay their respects to Chloe and Aubrey. As a First Nations drumming circle, provided a soulful backdrop well into the night. Leading the vigil, Hazel Braithwaite, acting mayor of Oak Bay, addressed the crowd with somber sincerity, stating, "We have all been shaken by this tragic event, not only here in Oak Bay but across our city, our province and our nation." Reverend Slater shared a heartfelt email from Chloe and Aubrey's grandparents, Brenda and Malcolm. In their message, they expressed deep gratitude for the overwhelming support extended to them and Sarah during this desperate time. They spoke tenderly of the girls as the light of their lives and a significant presence in their extremely small family. The letter extended thanks to everybody who had forged wonderful friendships with the girls and acknowledged the first responders at the crime scene on Christmas evening. Following the moving service, it was announced that a scholarship fund had been established in Chloe and Aubrey's memory. The Chloe and Aubrey Berry Scholarship Fund was created to provide support for scholarships at Christ Church Cathedral School, where Chloe was enrolled in grade 1. As the community grappled to make sense of the tragedy, the investigation persisted. Details of the custody battle began to emerge, prompting Bernard Richard, British Columbia's independent advocate for children and youth, to announce that his office was actively collecting information for a potential review. The objective was to determine whether Chloe and Aubrey had experienced shortcomings in the child protection services. Simultaneously, the Ministry of Children and Family Development declared their commitment to conducting a thorough review of their handling of the case. Past investigations into Andrew had occurred, triggered by Aubrey's allegations of inappropriate touching and her return from his care with a concerning soft spot on her head. The custody battle itself came under scrutiny, with Angela Marie McDougall from Battered Women Support Services highlighting the need for enhanced training to help judges recognise the warning signs of family violence. McDougall emphasised the gravity of domestic homicide as a predictable yet preventable crime, attributing failure to take it seriously to systemic issues of minimalisation and denial. She specifically asserted that Justice Victoria Gray, the judge overseeing the custody battle, had downplayed the allegations against Andrew. In contrast, Miriam Crescivo, president of the Law Society of BC, held a differing perspective. She argued that the case was akin to the thousands of disputes processed by the courts annually, challenging the notion that it stood out as unique. Chief Justice Christopher Hinkson also spoke up in defence of the judge. He said he didn't think that the evidence presented during the custody battle could have suggested that Andrew was likely to commit murder. He pointed out that Justice Gray wasn't responsible for assessing Andrew's fitness to visit Chloe and Aubrey, but instead to figure out the logistics around shared custody. While investigations and reviews continued, a public funeral for Chloe and Aubrey took place at Christ Church Cathedral, drawing over 400 mourners. At the front of the church, a photograph of the sisters sat facing the pews, surrounded by flowers. Those in attendance wore pink and purple ribbons, the girls' favourite colours. Sarah sat at the very front of the church, clutching tightly to a tissue. The clergy described the funeral as home of memory and hope, but also acknowledged the anger and pain of what had happened. The girls' aunt, Emma Cotton, described them as true angels, who would forever be missed and loved. Following the service, the mourners filed into the Christ Church Cathedral School gym, where Chloe was a student. Everybody encircled Sarah, and they held her close. In the aftermath of the funeral, Chloe and Aubrey were cremated. Detective swiftly uncovered the stormy dynamics between Andrew and Sarah, along with the ongoing custody battle. Delving deeper into the investigation, a troubling financial portrait of Andrew emerged in the lead-up to the tragic murder of Chloe and Aubrey. Financial woes plagued Andrew as he resigned from his job at BC Ferries in May of 2017. He found himself consistently falling behind on rent payments and grappling with utility disconnections by BC Hydro. Compounding his troubles was Andrew's escalating gambling addiction, which had its roots in his days as a bellboy at Sutton Place, a downtown hotel where he earned up to $200 in cash per shift. Initially engaged in baccarat, a competitive card game, Andrew's approach shifted over time. Rather than leaving when he lost, he began borrowing money from fellow players, earning him the nickname Almost, due to his near misses when repaying borrowed sums. Following his separation from Sarah, Andrew's gambling habit spiralled out of control, and he was spending around $3,000 a month just gambling. Despite a momentary windfall of $100,000 in the fall of 2015, Andrew lost the entire sum within a week. Desperate for funds, Andrew allegedly borrowed $10,000 from an individual named Paul, but his mounting debt snowballed, accruing interest as his losses escalated. By the spring of 2017, Andrew allegedly found himself owing Paul a staggering $25,000, leading him to consider cashing in on his pension to settle the debt. Quitting his job at BC Ferries became a necessary step to access his pension, exacerbating Andrew's financial strain. With his visa and line of credit maxed out, and his bank accounts in perpetual overdraft, Andrew resorted to asking neighbours for food, citing an inability to afford meals for his daughters when they came to visit. Around a month before the tragic stabbing of Chloe and Aubrey, Andrew took an even darker turn, actively searching for suicide methods, signalling a troubling escalation of his despair. Detectives believe that somewhere along the way, the girls became part of Andrew's suicide plot. In March, it was announced that the murder case would forego preliminary hearings, proceeding directly to the Supreme Court. As the months passed, the approach of Christmas 2018 loomed steadily. On the anniversary of the girls' murder, Sarah urged everyone to concentrate on their light, rather than the darkness surrounding their deaths. In a statement to Black Press, she expressed, "In looking ahead to Christmas, I want to find a way to remember and celebrate Chloe and Aubrey and the joy and love they brought all of us." April marked the commencement of jury selection for the murder trial, culminating in the finalisation of the jury on the 16th. During opening statements, Prosecutor Claire Jennings provided the jury with a detailed overview of what to expect during the trial. She outlined the deteriorating relationship between Andrew and Sarah, highlighting Andrew's financial struggles leading up to the double murder. Furthermore, she revealed that Andrew had been researching suicide methods just a month prior to the tragic events. The trial's first witness, Constable Peter Olenowski, the initial officer at the scene, testified. Following his account, defense attorney Kevin McCulloch accused detectives of mishandling the case. McCulloch argued that they exhibited tunnel vision, solely focusing on Andrew as the killer. He suggested that Constable Olenowski's decision to leave the apartment to wait for backup was a mistake, contending that the real killer might have escaped during that interval. The defense hadn't presented any opening statements, but it quickly became apparent that their defense was that Andrew was innocent. Defense attorney McCulloch suggested it would have taken somebody seconds to leave through a back exit door while the constable stood outside. His testimony was followed by Sergeant Michael Martin, his supervisor. He was asked by prosecutor Patrick Ware if he thought about freezing the crime scene until obtaining a warrant. He said no, but then said yes, but added he didn't think that it was a prudent thing to do in responding to the call. He testified that his priority upon his arrival at the apartment was to get in as fast as possible and render assistance to anybody who may have needed it. Brad Trenholm of the Oak Bay Fire Department testified next. He said that he knew the call would be traumatic as soon as it was engaged, but he had no memory of forming conclusions about what happened while at the apartment. He emotionally told the jury, "I can't remember most of the night, to be honest. I don't know if that's from the nature of the call. With children involved, it's quite traumatic." He testified that his paramedics worked on Andrew in the bathroom. He asked them to kill him. After testimony focusing on the crime scene, defense attorney McCulloch made reference to another crime that happened on the 25th of April 2017. A woman was stabbed and slashed around a kilometre away from Andrew's apartment, and nobody had been arrested in connection with it. The defense attorney was evidently trying to hint that the person who perpetrated that attack may have perpetrated the double murder of Chloe and Aubrey. Following this testimony, the bloody pajamas that the girls were wearing when they were killed were presented to the courtroom. Chloe's pajama shirt was so saturated in blood that only a small dry patch revealed the shirt's original light pink colour. There were puncture holes all across the shirt, including the front, back, and sides. Aubrey's pajama shirt was also so stained in blood that the original colour, purple with white oils, was indistinguishable. Her shirt had stab wounds to the arms, the wrist, and the front and back. Andrew, who was sitting alongside his defence team, burst into tears, which resulted in his defence attorney asking for a break. Upon their return to the courtroom, more evidence from inside the apartment was presented. The jury heard about Andrew's bloodstained clothing found in the bathroom and the lack of a forced entry. Testimony was also presented about the blood found inside the kitchen drawer, while it was also revealed that there were no bloody shoe prints in the apartment, only bloody sock prints. Sergeant Kimberly Tremblay testified about the blood evidence, telling the jury, "Given the blood evidence in each room, the spatter stains as well as the drip stains and saturation stains, I don't know if I could say it was just one individual or it was multiple individuals, given that both rooms had similar characteristics." After the forensic evidence was presented, Sarah was called to testify. She detailed the events leading up to the murders, telling the court that she was so concerned about the girls staying with Andrew because he had no electric or heat. After dropping them off, she had sent Andrew a couple of emails, but he didn't reply to them. She had an app that notified her when her emails were read, and she testified that one was read on the 21st of December, but the rest were ignored. She testified about the moment she learned her girls had been killed before defense attorney McCulloch read aloud text and email exchanges between Sarah and Andrew. These messages were all centered around arranging pickups, drop-offs, and field trip preparations. He said that they demonstrated a good co-parenting relationship. Sarah agreed, telling the courtroom, "I felt like it was in the best interest of the girls to communicate as much as possible." When she was asked whether Andrew was trying his best, she replied, "I don't know, you would have to ask him." During cross-examination, Sarah spoke about the custody agreement. Andrew's defence accused her of making up allegations that he had inappropriately touched Aubrey. She denied that she had, telling him that she reported what Aubrey had told her because it was her responsibility to. Following her testimony, Valley Travers took to the witness stand. She lived above Andrew and testified about the noises she heard coming from the apartment the morning the girls were discovered dead. She said that there were loud movements in the apartment, but she didn't hear any screaming, nor did she hear the girls' footsteps at all. During the trial's second week, a profound hush enveloped the courtroom as Andrew's defence team presented their opening statements. It was their case that the murders of Chloe and Aubrey were connected to the substantial debt that Andrew allegedly owed to a loan shark named Paul. Andrew assumed his place on the witness stand. He adamantly asserted his innocence in the deaths of Chloe and Aubrey and denied any attempt on his own life. Andrew candidly unraveled the narrative of his gambling addiction, exposing his alleged financial entanglements with a man named Paul. He testified that he had asked Paul for an extension to pay back the gambling debt that he owed. According to Andrew, Paul said that there was a catch, that he had to store a bag in his apartment. In a calm tone, he said to the jury, "I wouldn't have to do anything. I wouldn't have to see it. I wouldn't have to touch it." Under the probing questions of defence attorney McCulloch, Andrew speculated on the bag's contents, leaning on common sense to suggest its likely illegal nature, possibly involving drugs. According to Andrew's testimony, in March, two young Asian men, one who had a sleeve of tattoos, stowed the bag in the top shelf of his closet. He continued, stating that by April, the bag was retrieved. Yet despite his efforts to scrape together funds over subsequent months, it proved insufficient. The funds Andrew managed to amass were perceived as interest, leaving him burdened with an additional $25,000 on top of the original debt. Andrew revealed that Paul once again requested him to hold another bag, but this time he had to surrender the keys to his apartment. He said that he didn't hear from Paul or the other two men between the second bag drop in November and Christmas Day. When questioned about Paul, Andrew asserted his lack of knowledge regarding Paul's surname, noting only that Paul was a tall, Chinese man in his 50s. The focus then shifted to the events of Christmas morning. Andrew recounted that he and the girls had spent several hours playing in the snow. Upon their return to the apartment, he described the process of removing Chloe and Aubrey's wet clothing and dressing them in their pajamas. However, Andrew said he then went into the bedroom. He said that he was abruptly tackled onto the bed and then stabbed in the throat. He vividly expressed the searing pain coursing through his body before he lost consciousness. Amid sobs, Andrew emotionally testified, "When I wake up, I crawl over to Chloe's bed and prop myself up onto my knees, and I reach out and touch Chloe, and she's dead, and there's blood everywhere. There's just blood everywhere." According to Andrew, he then moved to the kitchen where he grabbed a knife in an effort to defend himself. However, he said that he was overpowered again, thrown to the ground and then stabbed once more. Andrew described the assailant as someone of similar height with dark skin and dark hair, but insisted it wasn't one of the individuals associated with Paul or Paul himself. He recollected, "The next memory I have is waking up in the bathtub, surrounded by the sounds of police." During cross-examination, Andrew addressed the suicide note discovered in the apartment. He claimed that he wrote it back in November, revealing that he had attempted suicide by hanging towards the end of that month. The prosecution asked Andrew whether he was worried about Chloe and Aubrey's safety when he was storing what was presumably drugs at his apartment. He said in hindsight it was potentially very dangerous, but at the time he didn't think that it was a big deal. Prosecutor Patrick Ware then posed the question which had been on everyone's mind in the courtroom. If Andrew Berry was genuinely innocent, why had he not disclosed crucial information to anyone immediately after the incident? Not a single inquiry about the well-being of his daughters was made during his time at the hospital, nor did he mention the narrative of an intruder. Andrew's response was that he simply wished to be left alone to die. Following Andrew's testimony, the trial concluded. In his closing arguments, defence attorney Kevin McCulloch emphasised the importance of reasonable doubt and the presumption of innocence. He repeatedly asserted that it was the Crown's responsibility to conclusively prove Andrew's guilt. McCulloch contended, "When you peel back the onion on this case, the Crown has not proven Mr. Berry's innocence beyond a reasonable doubt." He characterised the entire case as circumstantial, emphasising that the only certain facts were the location and timing of Andrew and the girl's discovery. The defence pointed to the suicide note, arguing that it demonstrated Andrew's concern for his daughter's well-being. McCulloch addressed the jury, "That should leave you with doubt. He was wanting to make sure the girls were protected." The defence also touched on Andrew's research into peaceful suicide methods, questioning the logic of his injuries. The prosecution, led by Patrick Ware, presented a contrasting perspective. Prosecutor Ware asserted that Andrew was responsible for the murders, citing resentment towards Sarah as the motive. He suggested that, facing the prospect of losing custody of the girls due to financial instability and a hazardous living environment, Andrew decided that if he couldn't have them, neither could Sarah. The prosecutor dismissed Andrew's claims of an intruder, stating, "Like everything in his life, he wouldn't accept responsibility. There was no Paul, no dark-skinned child murderer. It's self-serving, illogical, and at some point defies the laws of physics. Ladies and gentlemen, this attack simply didn't happen." After the closing arguments, the jury deliberated for 3 days before delivering a verdict. They found Andrew Berry guilty on both counts of second-degree murder. During the sentencing phase which followed, Crown Counsel Claire Jennings expressed uncertainty about which daughter was killed first. She suggested that Andrew would have witnessed the consequences of his stabbings before moving on to the second daughter, indicating a significant time lapse. The prosecution sought the harshest sentence, while the defence proposed 15 to 20 years. Before the sentence was announced, Sarah delivered a poignant victim impact statement, describing the loss of her 2 daughters as an enduring nightmare. The entire courtroom was moved as she detailed the profound effect on her family, including her aunt's deterioration of cerebral palsy, from high-functioning to bedridden. She said that the girls' friends continued to ask about them even 2 years later. Andrew Berry was ultimately sentenced to life in prison with a minimum term of 22 years. The courtroom was stunned, with many feeling that the minimum sentence fell far short of justice. Andrew Berry will be eligible for parole at the age of 67, but Chloe and Aubrey will forever remain 6 and 4 in the hearts of those who mourn their tragic loss. On what should have been a day of warmth, love and security, Christmas Day, Chloe and Aubrey Berry found themselves in the one place where safety should have been unquestionable, their own father's home. However, Andrew Berry's life had been in a downward spiral for some time, and instead of get help, he exacted revenge on their mother in the worst imaginable way. Well, besties, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening. And I'd like to say a massive thank you to my newest supporter up on Patreon, Terry. As you all know, Morbidology is a one-woman team, so the support up on Patreon seriously goes such a long way, especially as we go into the new year, where adverts on the show are few and far between. If you'd like to support the show up on Patreon, the link is in the show notes. In exchange for your support, I upload ad-free and early release episodes, behind the scenes, as well as bonus episodes of Morbidology Plus that aren't on the regular podcast platforms. If you'd like to support the show in another way, please consider leaving me a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you're listening. Remember to check us out at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. Until next time, take care of yourselves. Stay safe and have an amazing week.